Random House Audio presents Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, by Lawrence Wright. Read for you by Morton Sellers, with an introduction read by the author.
Introduction. Scientology plays an outsized role in the cast of new religions that have arisen in the 20th century and survived into the 21st. The church won't release official membership figures, but informally it claims 8 million members worldwide, a figure that is based on the number of people who have donated to the church. A recent ad claims that the church welcomes 4.4 million new people every year. And yet, according to a former spokesperson for the church, the International Association of Scientologists, an organization that church members are forcefully encouraged to join, has only about 30,000 members. The largest concentration, about 5,000, is in Los Angeles. A survey of American religious affiliations compiled in the Statistical Abstract of the United States estimates that only 25,000 Americans actually call themselves Scientologists. That's less than half the number identifying themselves as Rastafarians. Despite decades of declining membership and intermittent scandals that might have sunk other faiths, Scientology remains afloat more than a quarter century after the death of its chimerical leader, L. Ron Hubbard. In part, its survival is due to colossal financial resources, about $1 billion in liquid assets, according to knowledgeable former members. Strictly in terms of cash reserves, that figure eclipses the holdings of most major world religions. Scientology's wealth testifies to the avidity of its membership, relentless fundraising, and the legacy of Hubbard's copyrights to the 1,000 books and articles he published. The church also claims about 12 million square feet of property around the world. Hollywood is the center of Scientology's real estate empire, with 26 properties valued at $400 million. The most recent addition to the church's Hollywood portfolio is a television studio on Sunset Boulevard, formerly owned by KCET, acquired in order to open a Scientology broadcasting center. In Clearwater, Florida, where Scientology maintains its spiritual headquarters, the church owns 68 largely tax-exempt parcels of land, valued at $168 million. They include apartment buildings, hotels and motels, warehouses, schools, office buildings, a bank, and tracts of vacant land. The church often acquires landmark buildings near key locations, such as Music Row in Nashville, DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and Times Square in New York City. A similar strategy governs the placement of Scientology's holdings in other countries. Typically, these buildings are magnificently restored architectural treasures, lavishly appointed, even if the membership is negligible. The church owns a 500-acre compound in Southern California and a cruise ship, the Freewinds, which is based in the Caribbean. The Church of Spiritual Technology, the branch of Scientology that owns the trademarks and copyrights to all church materials, including Hubbard's immense body of popular fiction, maintains secret bases in several remote locations in at least 3 American states, where the founders' works are stored in titanium canisters in nuclear blast-resistant caverns. One of the vault locations, in Trementina, New Mexico, has an airstrip and 2 giant interlocking circles carved into the desert floor, a landmark for UFOs, some believe, or for Hubbard's reincarnated spirit when he chooses to return. There are really 3 tiers of Scientologists. Public Scientologists constitute the majority of the membership. Many of them have their first exposure to the religion at a subway station or a shopping mall, where they might take a free stress test or a personality inventory called the Oxford Capacity Analysis. There is no actual connection to Oxford University. On those occasions, potential recruits are likely to be told that they have problems that Scientology can resolve, and they are steered to a local church or mission for courses or therapy, which the church terms auditing. That's as far as most new members go, but others begin a lengthy and expensive climb up the church's spiritual ladder. The mystique that surrounds the religion is owed mainly to the second tier of membership, a small number of Hollywood actors and other celebrities. To promote the idea that Scientology is a unique refuge for spiritually hungry movie stars, as well as a kind of factory for stardom, the church operates celebrity centers in Hollywood and several other entertainment hubs. Any Scientologist can take courses at celebrity centers. It's part of the lure that an ordinary member can envision being in classes with notable actors or musicians. In practice, the real celebrities have their own private entry and course rooms, and they rarely mix with the public, except for major contributors who are accorded the same heightened status. The total number of celebrities in the church is impossible to calculate, both because the term itself is so elastic and because some well-known personalities who have taken courses or auditing don't wish to have their association known. An ordinary public Scientologist can be inconspicuous. No one really needs to know his beliefs. Public members who quit the church seldom make a scene. They just quietly remove themselves and the community closes the circle behind them. Although they are likely to be pursued by mail and phone solicitations for the rest of their lives. Celebrity members, on the other hand, are constantly being pressed to add their names to petitions, being showcased at workshops and galas, or having their photos posted over the logo, "I am a Scientologist." Their fame greatly magnifies the influence of the church. They are deployed to advance the social agendas of the organization, including attacks on psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry, and the promotion of Hubbard's contested theories of education and drug rehabilitation. They become tied to Scientology's banner, which makes it more difficult to break away if they should become disillusioned. Neither the public nor the celebrity tiers of Scientology could exist without the third level of membership, the church's clergy, called the Sea Organization, or Sea Org, in Scientology jargon. It is an artifact of the private navy that Hubbard commanded during a decade when he was running the church while on the high seas. The church has said on various occasions that the Sea Org has 5,000, 6,000, or 10,000 members worldwide. Former Sea Org members estimate the actual size of the clergy to be between 3,000 and 5,000. Concentrated mainly in Clearwater, Florida, and Los Angeles. Many of them joined the Sea Org as children. They have sacrificed their education and are impoverished by their service. As a symbol of their unswerving dedication to the promotion of Hubbard's principles, they have signed contracts for a billion years of service. Only a brief moment in the eternal scheme as seen by Scientology, which postulates that the universe is 4 quadrillion years old. The church disputes the testimony of many of the sources I've spoken to for this book, especially those former members of the Sea Org who have now left the organization, calling them apostates and defectors. It is certainly true that a number of them no longer accept the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard, but many still consider themselves fervent Scientologists, saying that it was the church itself that has strayed from his example. They include some of the highest officials who have ever served in the organization. Scientology is certainly among the most stigmatized religions in the world, owing to its eccentric cosmology, its vindictive behavior towards critics and defectors, and the damage it has inflicted on families that have been broken apart by the church's policy of disconnection. The imposed isolation of church members from people who stand in the way of their longed-for spiritual progress. In the United States, constitutional guarantees of religious liberty protect the church from actions that might otherwise be considered abusive, or in violation of laws and human trafficking or labor standards. Many of these practices are well known to the public. And yet curious recruits continue to be attracted to the religion, though not in the numbers that Scientology claims. Celebrities still find their way to the church's VIP lounge. And young people sign away the next billion years of their existence to an organization that promises to work them mercilessly for practically no pay. Obviously, there is an enduring appeal that survives the widespread assumption that Scientology is a cult and a fraud. I have spent much of my career examining the effects of religious beliefs on people's lives, historically a far more profound influence on society and individuals than politics, which is the substance of so much journalism. I was drawn to write this book by the questions that many people have about Scientology. What is it that makes the religion alluring? What do its adherents get out of it? How can seemingly rational people subscribe to beliefs that others find incomprehensible? Why do popular personalities associate themselves with a faith that is likely to create a kind of public relations martyrdom? These questions are not unique to Scientology, but they certainly underscore the conversation. In attempting to answer them in this book, I hope we can learn something about what might be called the process of belief. Few Scientologists have had a conversion experience, a sudden radical reorientation of one's life. More common is a gradual wholehearted acceptance of propositions that might have been regarded as unacceptable or absurd at the outset, as well as the incremental surrender of will on the part of people who have been promised enhanced power and authority. One can see by this example the motor that propels all great social movements for good or ill. Lawrence Wright, Austin, Texas.
Part 1. Scientology. Chapter 1. The Convert. London, Ontario, is a middling manufacturing town halfway between Toronto and Detroit, once known for its cigars and breweries. In a tribute to its famous namesake, London has its own Covent Garden, Piccadilly Street, and even a Thames River that forks around the modest, economically stressed downtown. The city, which sits in a humid basin, is remarked upon for its unpleasant weather. Summers are unusually hot, winters brutally cold, the springs and falls fine but fleeting. The most notable native son was the bandleader Guy Lombardo, who was honored in a local museum until it closed for lack of visitors. London was a difficult place for an artist looking to find himself. Paul Haggis was 21 years old in 1975. He was walking toward a record store in downtown London when he encountered a fast-talking, long-haired young man with piercing eyes standing on the corner of Dundas and Waterloo Streets. There was something keen and strangely adamant in his manner. His name was Jim Logan. He pressed a book into Haggis's hands. "You have a mind," Logan said. "This is the owner's manual." Then he demanded, "Give me $2. The book was Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health by L. Ron Hubbard, which was published in 1950. By the time Logan pushed it on Haggis, the book had sold more than 2 million copies throughout the world. Haggis opened the book and saw a page stamped with the words, "Church of Scientology." "Take me there," he said to Logan. At the time, there were only a handful of Scientologists in the entire province of Ontario. By coincidence, Haggis had heard about the organization a couple of months earlier from a friend who had called it a cult. That interested Haggis. He considered the possibility of doing a documentary film about it. When he arrived at the church's quarters in London, it certainly didn't look like a cult. Two young men occupying a hole-in-the-wall office above Woolworth's Five and Dime. As an atheist, Haggis was wary of being dragged into a formal belief system. In response to his skepticism, Logan showed him a passage by Hubbard that read, "What is true is what is true for you. No one has any right to force data on you and command you to believe it or else. If it is not true for you, it isn't true. Think your own way through things, accept what is true for you, discard the rest. There is nothing unhappier than one who tries to live in a chaos of lies." These words resonated with Haggis. Although he didn't realize it, Haggis was being drawn into the church through a classic four-step dissemination drill that recruiters are carefully trained to follow. The first step is to make contact, as Jim Logan did with Haggis in 1975. The second step is to disarm any antagonism the individual may display toward Scientology. Once that's done, the task is to find the ruin, that is, the problem most on the mind of the potential recruit. For Paul, it was a turbulent romance. The fourth step is to convince the subject that Scientology has the answer. Once the person is aware of the ruin, you bring about an understanding that Scientology can handle the condition, Hubbard writes. It's at the right moment on this step that one directs him to the service that will best handle what he needs handled. At that point, the potential recruit has officially been transformed into a Scientologist. Paul responded to every step in an almost ideal manner. He and his girlfriend took a course together and, shortly thereafter, became Hubbard-qualified Scientologists, one of the first levels in what the church calls the bridge to total freedom. Haggis was born in 1953, the oldest of three children. His father, Ted, ran a construction company specializing in road work, mostly laying asphalt and pouring sidewalks, curbs, and gutters. He called his company Global because he was serving both London and Paris, another Ontario community 50 miles to the east. As Ted was getting his business started, the family lived in a small house in the predominantly white town. The Haggises were one of the few Catholic families in a Protestant neighborhood, which led to occasional confrontations, including a schoolyard fistfight that left Paul with a broken nose. Although he didn't really think of himself as religious, he identified with being a minority. However, his mother, Mary, insisted on sending Paul and his two younger sisters, Kathy and Joe, to Mass every Sunday. One day she spotted their priest driving an expensive car. "God wants me to have a Cadillac," the priest explained. Mary responded, "Then God doesn't want us in your church anymore." Paul admired his mother's stand. He knew how much her religion meant to her. After that, the family stopped going to Mass, but the children continued in Catholic schools. Ted's construction business prospered to the point that he was able to buy a much larger house on 18 acres of rolling land outside of town. There were a couple of horses in the stable, a Chrysler station wagon in the garage, and giant construction vehicles parked in the yard like grazing dinosaurs. Paul spent a lot of time alone. He could walk the mile to catch the school bus and not see anyone along the way. His chores were to clean the horse stalls and the dog runs. Ted raised spaniels for field trials. At home, Paul made himself the center of attention. "The apple of his mother's eye," his father recalled. But he was mischievous and full of pranks. "He got the strap when he was 5 years old," Ted said. When Paul was about 13, he was taken to say farewell to his grandfather on his deathbed. The old man had been a janitor in a bowling alley, having fled England because of some mysterious scandal. He seemed to recognize a similar dangerous quality in Paul. His parting words to him were, "I've wasted my life. Don't waste yours." In high school, Paul began steering toward trouble. His worried parents sent him to Ridley College, a boarding school in St. Catharines, Ontario, near Niagara Falls, where he was required to be a part of the cadet corps of the Royal Canadian Army. He despised marching or any regulated behavior and soon began skipping the compulsory drills. He would sit in his room reading Ramparts, the radical magazine that chronicled the social revolutions then unfolding in America, where he longed to be. He was constantly getting punished for his infractions until he taught himself to pick locks. Then he could sneak into the prefect's office and mark off his demerits. The experience sharpened an incipient talent for subversion. After a year of this, his parents transferred him to a progressive boys' school called Muskoka Lakes College in northern Ontario, where there was very little system to subvert. Although it was called a college, it was basically a preparatory school. Students were encouraged to study whatever they wanted. Paul discovered a mentor in his art teacher, Max Allen, who was gay and politically radical. Allen produced a show for the Canadian Broadcasting Company called As It Happens. In 1973, while the Watergate hearings were going on in Washington, D.C., Allen let Paul sit beside him in his cubicle at CBC while he edited John Dean's testimony for broadcast. Later, Allen opened a small theater in Toronto to show movies that had been banned under Ontario's draconian censorship laws. And Paul volunteered at the box office. They showed Ken Russell's The Devils and Bernardo Bertolucci's Last Tango in Paris. In Ted's mind, his son was working in a porno theater. "I just shut my eyes," Ted said. Paul left school after he was caught forging a check. He attended art school briefly and took some film classes at a community college, but he dropped out of that as well. He grew his curly blonde hair to his shoulders. He began working in construction full-time for Ted, but he was drifting toward a precipice. In the 1970s, London acquired the nickname Speed City because of the methamphetamine labs that sprang up to serve its blossoming underworld. Hard drugs were easy to obtain. Two of Haggis's friends died from overdoses, and he had a gun pointed in his face a couple of times. "I was a bad kid," he admitted. "I didn't kill anybody. Not that I didn't try." He also acted as a stage manager in the 99-seat theater his father created in an abandoned church for one of his stage-struck daughters. On Sunday nights, Paul would strike the set of whatever show was underway and put up a movie screen. In that way, he introduced himself and the small community of film buffs in London to the works of Bergman, Hitchcock, and the French New Wave. He was so affected by Michelangelo Antonioni's blow-up that in 1974 he decided to become a fashion photographer in England, like the hero of that movie. That lasted less than a year, but when he returned, he still carried a Leica over his shoulder. Back in London, Ontario, he fell in love with a nursing student named Diane Geddes. They began sharing a one-bedroom apartment filled with Paul's books on film. He thought of himself then as a loner and an artist and an iconoclast. His grades were too poor to get into college. He could see that he was going nowhere. He was ready to change, but he wasn't sure how. Such was Paul Haggis's state of mind when he joined the Church of Scientology. Like every Scientologist, when Haggis entered the church, he took his first steps into the mind of L. Ron Hubbard. He read about Hubbard's adventurous life, how he wandered the world, led dangerous expeditions, and healed himself of crippling war injuries through the techniques that he developed into Dianetics. He was not a prophet like Muhammad, or divine like Jesus. He had not been visited by an angel bearing tablets of revelation like Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. Scientologists believe that Hubbard discovered the existential truths that form their doctrine through extensive research. In that way, it is science. The apparent rationalism appealed to Haggis. He had long since walked away from the religion of his upbringing, but he was still looking for a way to express his idealism. It was important to him that Scientology didn't demand belief in a god. But the figure of L. Ron Hubbard did hover over the religion in suggestive ways. He wasn't worshipped exactly, but his visage and name were everywhere, like the absolute ruler of a small kingdom. There seemed to be two Hubbards within the church, the godlike authority whose every word was regarded as scripture, and the avuncular figure that Haggis saw on the training videos, who came across as wry and self-deprecating. Those were qualities that Haggis shared to a marked degree, and they inspired trust in the man he had come to accept as his spiritual guide. Still, Haggis felt a little stranded by the lack of irony among his fellow Scientologists. Their inability to laugh at themselves seemed at odds with the character of Hubbard himself. He didn't seem self-important or pious. He was like the dashing, wisecracking hero of a B-movie who had seen everything and somehow had it all figured out. When Haggis experienced doubts about the religion, he reflected on the 16mm films of Hubbard's lectures from the 1950s and 1960s, which were part of the church's indoctrination process. Hubbard was always chuckling to himself, marveling over some random observation that had just occurred to him, with a little wink to the audience, suggesting that they not take him too seriously. He would just open his mouth, and a mob of new thoughts would burst forth, elbowing each other in the race to make themselves known to the world. They were often trivial and disjointed, but also full of obscure, learned references and charged with a sense of originality and purpose. "You walked in one day and you said, 'I'm a seneschal,'" Hubbard observed in a characteristic aside, "and this knight with 8-inch spurs standing there, humph, and say, 'I'm supposed to open the doors to this castle. I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm a very trusted retainer.' He's insisting he's the seneschal, but nobody will pay him his wages and so forth. He was somebody before he became the seneschal. Now, as a seneschal, he became nobody until he finally went out and got a begging pan on the highway and began to hold it out for fish and chips as people came along, you know. Now he says, 'I am something. I am a beggar.' But that's still something. Then the New York State Police come along, or somebody, and they say to him, I'm a little mixed up in my periods here, but they say to him, 'Do you realize you cannot beg upon the public road without license number 603F? So he starves to death and kicks the bucket, and there he lies. Now he's somebody. He's a corpse, but he's not dead. He's merely a corpse. Got the idea? But he goes through sequences of becoming nobody, somebody, nobody, somebody, nobody, somebody, nobody, not necessarily on a dwindling spiral. Some people get up to the point of being a happy man. You know the old story of a happy man. I won't tell it. He didn't have a shirt." Just as this fuzzy parable begins to ramble into incoherence, Hubbard comes to the point, which is that a being is not his occupation or even the body he presently inhabits. The central insight of Scientology is that the being is eternal, what Hubbard terms a thetan. This chap, in other words, was somebody until he began to identify his beingness with a thing. None of these beingnesses are the person. The person is the thetan. "He had this amazing buoyancy," Haggis recalled. "He had a deadpan sense of humor and this sense of himself that seemed to say, 'Yes, I am fully aware that I might be mad, but I also might be onto something.'" The zealotry that empowered so many members of the church came from the belief that they were the vanguard of the struggle to save humanity. A civilization without insanity, without criminals and without war, where the able can prosper and honest beings can have rights, and where man is free to rise to greater heights, are the aims of Scientology, Hubbard writes. Those breathless aims drew young idealists like Haggis to the church's banner. To advance such lofty goals, Hubbard developed a technology to attain spiritual freedom and discover oneself as an immortal being. "Scientology works 100% of the time when it is properly applied to a person who sincerely desires to improve his life," a church publication declares. This guarantee rests on the assumption that, through rigorous research, Hubbard had uncovered a perfect understanding of human nature. One must not stray from the path he has laid down or question his methods. Scientology is exact. Scientology is certain. Step by step, one can ascend toward clarity and power, becoming more oneself, but paradoxically, also more like Hubbard. Scientology is the geography of his mind. Perhaps no individual in history has taken such copious internal soundings and described with so much logic and minute detail the inner workings of his own mentality. The method Hubbard put forward created a roadmap toward his own ideal self. Hubbard's habits, his imagination, his goals and wishes, his character, in other words, became both the basis and the destination of Scientology. Secretly, Haggis didn't really respect Hubbard as a writer. He hadn't been able to get through Dianetics, for instance. He read about 30 pages, then put it down. Much of the Scientology coursework, however, gave him a feeling of accomplishment. In 1976, he traveled to Los Angeles, the center of the Scientology universe, checking in at the old Chateau Elysee on Franklin Avenue. Clark Gable and Katharine Hepburn had once stayed there, along with many other stars, but when Haggis arrived, it was a run-down church retreat called the Manor Hotel. Footnote: it has since been spectacularly renovated and turned into Scientology's premier celebrity center. End footnote. He had a little apartment with a kitchen where he could write. There were about 30,000 Scientologists in America at the time. Most of them were white, urban, and middle class. They were predominantly in their 20s, and many of them, especially in Los Angeles, were involved in graphic or performing arts. In other words, they were a lot like Paul Haggis. He immediately became a part of a community in a city that can otherwise be quite isolating. For the first time in his life, he experienced a feeling of kinship and camaraderie with people who had a lot in common. All these atheists looking for something to believe in, and all these wanderers looking for a club to join. In 1977, Haggis returned to Canada to continue working for his father, who could see that his son was struggling. Ted Haggis asked him what he wanted to do with his life. Haggis said he wanted to be a writer. His father said, "Well, there are only two places to do that, New York and Los Angeles. Pick one, and I'll keep you on the payroll for a year." Paul chose L.A. because it was the heart of the film world. Soon after this conversation with his father, Haggis and Diane Geddes got married. 2 months later, they loaded up his brown Camaro and drove to Los Angeles, moving into an apartment with Diane's brother, Greg, and three other people. Paul got a job moving furniture. On the weekends, he took photographs for yearbooks. At night, he wrote scripts on spec at a second-hand drafting table. The following year, Diane gave birth to their first child, Alyssa. Scientology had a giddy and playful air in the mid-70s when Haggis arrived in Los Angeles. It was seen as a cool boutique religion aimed especially toward the needs of artists and entertainers. The counterculture was still thriving in the 70s, and Scientology both was a part of it and stood apart from it. There was a saying, "After drugs, there's Scientology." And it was true that many who were drawn to the religion had taken hallucinogens and were open to alternative realities. Recruits had a sense of boundless possibility. Mystical powers were forecast. Out-of-body experiences were to be expected. Fundamental secrets of the universe were to be revealed. Haggis became friends with other Scientologists who also hoped to make it in Hollywood. One of them was Skip Press, a writer and musician on the staff of the Celebrity Center, which was the church's main foothold in the entertainment industry. Like many young recruits, Press believed that Scientology had given him superhuman powers. For instance, he believed that when he got into the right mental state, he could change traffic lights to green. He and Haggis formed a casual self-help group with other aspiring writers. They met at a Scientology hangout across from the Celebrity Center called $2 Bills, where they would criticize each other's work and scheme about how to get ahead. Eventually, this informal writers' club came to the attention of Yvonne Gillam, the charismatic founder of the Celebrity Center. Naturally warm and energetic, Gillam was an ideal candidate to woo the kinds of artists and opinion leaders that Hubbard sought to front his religion. The former kindergarten director staged parties, poetry readings, workshops, and dances. Chick Corea and other musicians associated with the church often played there. Gillam persuaded Haggis and his circle to hold their meetings at the Celebrity Center, and they were folded into her web. Haggis and a friend from the Writers' Club eventually got a job scripting cartoons for Ruby Spears Productions, beginning with a short-lived series called Dingbat and the Creeps, then Heathcliff. After that, Haggis went on to write Richie Rich and Scooby-Doo for Hanna-Barbera. He bought a used IBM Selectric typewriter. His career began to creep forward. One day, a well-off strawberry farmer from Vancouver introduced himself to Haggis and Skip Press at the Celebrity Center, saying he wanted to produce a life story of L. Ron Hubbard. He was offering $15,000 for a script. Press declined, but Haggis accepted the money. His memory is that it was a horror script that he hoped to interest the strawberry farmer in. He never actually wrote a script about Hubbard, and eventually returned the entire sum, but in Press's opinion, that was when Haggis's career began to accelerate. The money enabled Paul to cruise a bit and develop his career. Next thing I knew, Paul was getting an agent. His Scientology connections were paying off. Haggis spent much of his time and money taking advanced courses and being audited, a kind of Scientology psychotherapy that involves the use of an electropsychometer, or E-meter. The device measures bodily changes in electrical resistance that occur when a person answers questions posed by an auditor. Hubbard compared it to a lie detector. The E-meter bolstered the church's claim to being a scientific path to spiritual discovery. It gives man his first keen look into the heads and hearts of his fellows, Hubbard claimed, adding that Scientology boosted some people's IQ 1 point for every hour of auditing. Our most spectacular feat was raising a boy from 83 IQ to 212, he once boasted to the Saturday Evening Post. The theory of auditing is that it locates and discharges mental masses that are blocking the free flow of energy. Ideas and fantasies are not immaterial. They have weight and solidity. They can root themselves in the mind as phobias and obsessions. Auditing breaks up the masses that occupy what Hubbard terms the reactive mind, which is where the fears and phobias reside. The E-meter is presumed to measure changes in those masses. If the needle on the meter moves to the right, resistance is rising. To the left, it is falling. The auditor asks systematic questions aimed at detecting sources of spiritual distress, problems at work or in a relationship, for instance. Whenever the client, or pre-clear, gives an answer that prompts the meter needle to jump, that subject becomes an area of concentration until the auditor is satisfied that emotional consequences of the troubling experience have drained away. Certain patterns of needle movement, such as sudden jumps or darts, long versus short falls, etc., have meaning as well. The auditor tries to guide the pre-clear to a cognition about the subject under examination, which leads to a floating needle. That doesn't necessarily mean that the needle is frozen. The needle just idles around and yawns at your questions, Hubbard explains. The individual should experience a corresponding feeling of release. Eventually, the reactive mind is cleansed of its obsessions, fears, and irrational urges, and the pre-clear becomes clear. Footnote. Hubbard sometimes disparaged the term lie detector in connection with e-meters. In the first place, they do not detect lies, and in the second place, the police have known too little about the human mind to know that their instrument was actually accurate to an amazing perfection. These instruments should be called emotion detectors. Hubbard, Electropsychometric Auditing Operator's Manual, 1952. According to David S. Turetsky, a research professor in computer science at Carnegie Mellon University and a prominent Scientology critic, what are called thoughts are actually fleeting patterns of chemical and electrical activity in our brains that have no actual mass. The meter is really more of a prop or talisman than a measuring instrument. Interpreting needle movements is like reading tea leaves. A good fortune teller picks up on lots of subliminal cues that let them read their subject, while the tea leaves give the subject something to fixate on. And the subject is heavily invested in believing that the auditor and the meter are effective, so it's a mutually reinforcing system. The e-meter measures skin resistance like a lie detector. Strong emotional reactions do cause changes in muscle tension, or micro tremors of the fingers will also cause changes in the current flowing to the meter. So it's not purely measuring the physiological changes associated with skin resistance like a real lie detector would. And real lie detectors also look at other variables such as pulse and respiration rates. David Turetsky, Personal Correspondence. End footnote. Haggis found the e-meter impressively responsive. He would grasp a cylindrical electrode in each hand. When he first joined Scientology, the electrodes were empty Campbell's soup cans with the labels stripped off. An imperceptible electrical charge would run from the meter through his body. The meter seemed able to gauge the kinds of thoughts he was having, whether they were scary or happy, or when he was hiding something. It was a little spooky. The auditor often probed for what Scientologists call earlier similars. If Paul was having another fight with Diane, for instance, the auditor would ask him, "Can you remember an earlier time when something like this happened?" Each new memory led further and further back in time. The goal was to uncover and neutralize the emotional memories that were plaguing Paul's behavior. Often the process led participants to recall past lives. Although that never happened to Haggis, he envied others who professed vivid recollections of ancient times or distant civilizations. "Wouldn't it be cool if you had many lifetimes before?" he thought. "Wouldn't it be easier to face death?" Scientology is not just a matter of belief, the recruits were constantly told. It is a step-by-step scientific process that will help you overcome your limitations and realize your full potential for greatness. Only Scientology can awaken individuals to the joyful truth of their immortal state. Only Scientology can rescue humanity from its inevitable doom. The recruits were infused with a sense of mystery, purpose, and intrigue. Life inside Scientology was just so much more compelling than life outside. Pre-clears sometimes experience mystical states characterized by feelings of bliss or a sense of blending into the universe. They come to expect such phenomena, and they yearn for them if they don't occur. Exteriorization, the sense that one has actually left his physical being behind, is a commonly reported occurrence for Scientologists. If one's consciousness can actually uproot itself from the physical body and move about at will, what does that say about mortality? We must be something other than a mere physical incarnation. We actually are thetans, to use Hubbard's term, immortal spiritual beings that are incarnated in innumerable lifetimes. Hubbard said that exteriorization could be accomplished in about half the pre-clears by having the auditor simply command, "Be 3 feet back of your head." Free of the limitations of his body, the Thetan can roam the universe, circling stars, strolling on Mars, or even creating entirely new universes. Reality expands far beyond what the individual had originally perceived it to be. The ultimate goal of auditing is not just to liberate a person from destructive mental phenomena, it is to emancipate him from the laws of matter, energy, space, and time, or MEST, as Hubbard termed them. These are just artifacts of the Thetan's imagination, in any case. Bored Thetans had created MEST universes where they could frolic and play games. Eventually, they became so absorbed in their distractions they forgot their true immortal natures. They identified with the bodies that they were temporarily inhabiting in a universe they had invented for their own amusement. The goal of Scientology is to recall to the Thetan his immortality and help him relinquish his self-imposed limitations. Once, Haggis had what he thought was an out-of-body experience. He was lying on a couch, and then he found himself across the room, observing himself lying there. The experience of being out of his body wasn't that grand, and later he wondered if he had simply been visualizing the scene. He didn't have the certainty his colleagues reported when they talked about seeing objects behind them or in distant places and times. In 1976, at the Manor Hotel, Haggis went clear. It is the base camp for those who hope to ascend to the upper peaks of Scientology. The concept comes from Dianetics. A person who becomes clear is adaptable to and able to change his environment, Hubbard writes. His ethical and moral standards are high, his ability to seek and experience pleasure is great. His personality is heightened, and he is creative and constructive. Among other qualities, the clear has a flawless memory and the capacity to perform mental tasks at unprecedented rates of speed. He is less susceptible to disease, and he is free of neuroses, compulsions, repressions, and psychosomatic illnesses. Hubbard sums up, "The Dianetic clear is to a current normal individual as the current normal is to the severely insane." Haggis was clear number 5925. "It was not life-changing," he admits. "It wasn't like, oh my God, I can fly." At every level of advancement, he was encouraged to write a success story, saying how effective his training had been. He had read many such stories by other Scientologists, and they felt overly effusive, geared toward getting through the gatekeepers so that the students could move on to the next level. The bridge to total freedom is a journey that goes on, although confoundingly in the Scientology metaphor, one moves higher and higher, up the bridge rather than across it. Haggis quickly advanced through the upper levels. He was becoming an operating Thetan, which the Church defines as one who can handle things and exist without physical support and assistance. An editorial in a 1958 issue of the Scientology magazine Ability notes that neither Buddha nor Jesus Christ were OTs, according to the evidence. They were just a shade above clear. When Haggis joined the Church, there were 7 levels of operating Thetans. According to Church documents that have been leaked online, Hubbard's handwritten instructions for operating Thetan Level 1 list 13 mental exercises that attune practitioners to their relationship with others. The directives for OT1 are so open-ended it could be difficult to know whether they have been satisfactorily accomplished. Note several large and several small male bodies until you have a cognition, for instance, or Seat yourself unobtrusively where you can observe a number of people, spot things and people you are not, due to cognition. The point is to familiarize oneself with one's environment from the perspective of being clear. In the second level, OT2, Scientologists attempt to delete past life implants that hinder progress in one's current existence. This is accomplished through exercises and visualizations that explore oppositional forces. Laughter comes from the rear half and calm from the front half simultaneously. Then they reverse. It gives one a sensation of total disagreement. The trick is to conceive of both at the same time. This tends to knock one out. Each new level of achievement marked the entrance to a more select spiritual fraternity. Haggis didn't have a strong reaction to the material, but then he wasn't expecting anything too profound. Everyone knew that the big revelations resided in OT3. Hubbard called this level the Wall of Fire. The material involved in this sector is so vicious that it is carefully arranged to kill anyone if he discovers the exact truth of it, he wrote in 1967. So in January and February of this year, I became very ill, almost lost this body, and somehow or another brought it off, and obtained the material, and was able to live through it. I am very sure that I was the first one that ever did live through any attempt to attain that material. In the late 70s, the OT mysteries were still unknown, except to the elect. There was no internet, and Scientology's confidential scriptures had never been published or produced in court. Scientologists looked toward the moment of initiation into OT3 with extreme curiosity and excitement. The candidate had to be invited into this next level. Scientologists were cautioned that the material could cause harm or even death to those who were unprepared to receive it. The enforced secrecy added to the mystique and the giddy air of adventure. One could look back at this crucial moment and examine the pros and cons of Haggis's decision to stay in Scientology. The fact that people often sneered at the church didn't deter him. On the contrary, he reveled in being a member of a stigmatized minority. It made him feel at one with other marginalized groups. The main drawback to belief was his own skeptical nature. He was a proud contrarian, and it would never have occurred to him to join the Baptist Church, for instance, or to return to Catholicism. He simply wasn't interested. Intellectually, faith didn't call to him. Scientology, on the other hand, was exotic and tantalizing. The weirdness of some of the doctrines was hard to fathom, but there was no doubt in Haggis's mind that he had gained some practical benefits from his several years of auditing and that his communication skills had improved through some of the coursework. None of that had required him to believe in Scientology, but the religion had proved itself in certain ways that mattered to him. The process of induction was so gradual that things that might have shocked him earlier were more acceptable by the time he came upon them. Whenever he ran into something on the bridge to total freedom that he couldn't fathom, he convinced himself that the next level would make everything understandable. Scientology was a part of his community. It had taken root in Hollywood, just as Haggis had. His first writing jobs had come through Scientology connections. His wife was deeply involved in the church, as was his sister, Kathy. His circle of friends was centered in the church. Haggis was deep enough into the process by now to understand implicitly that those relationships would be jeopardized if he chose to leave the church. Moreover, he had invested a considerable part of his income in the program. The incentive to believe was high. He was also looking forward to having the enhanced abilities that his fellow adherents on the bridge were constantly talking about. Although Hubbard had explicitly told operating thetans not to use their powers for parlor tricks, there was a section of Advance, a magazine for upper-level Scientologists, titled OT Phenomena, where members could report clairvoyant or paranormal experiences. Parking spaces magically made themselves available, and waiters immediately noticed you. I saw that my goldfish was all red and lumpy, one Scientologist writes in Advance. My husband, Rick, said that he's had goldfish like that before and they don't recover. The correspondent relates that she used her abilities to flow energy into the fish until a big burst of matter blew. I ended off. When I went home that night, the fish was completely healed. She concludes, "It was a big win for me and the fish. It couldn't have been done without the technology of L. Ron Hubbard." Even if such effects were random and difficult to replicate, for those who experienced them, life was suddenly full of unseen possibilities. There was a sense of having entered a sphere of transcendence, where minds communicate with each other across great distances, where wishes and intentions affect material objects, or cause people to unconsciously obey telepathic orders, or where spirits from other ages or even other worlds make themselves known. A theta being is capable of emitting a considerable electronic flow, Hubbard notes, enough to give somebody a very bad shock, to put out his eyes or cut him in half. Even ordinary actions pose unexpected dilemmas for the OT, Hubbard warns. How do you answer the phone as an OT? He asks in one of his lectures. Supposing you get mad at somebody on the other end of the telephone. You go crunch, and that's so much Bakelite. The thing either goes into a fog of dust in the middle of the air or drips over the floor. To avoid crushing telephones with his unfathomable strength, the OT sets up an automatic action so he doesn't have to pick the receiver up himself. Telephone rings, it springs into the air, and he talks. In other words, through involuntary intention, the telephone stands there in midair. The promise of employing such powers was incredibly tantalizing. Carrying an empty briefcase, Haggis went to the Advanced Organization building in Los Angeles, where the OT-3 material was held. A supervisor handed him a manila envelope. Haggis locked it in the briefcase, which was lashed to his arm. Then he entered a secure study room and bolted the door behind him. At last, he was able to examine the religion's highest mysteries, revealed in a couple of pages of Hubbard's handwritten scrawl. After a few minutes, Haggis returned to the supervisor. "I don't understand," Haggis said. "Do you know the words?" "I know the words, I just don't understand." "Go back and read it again," the supervisor suggested. Haggis did so. In a moment, he returned. "Is this a metaphor?" he asked. "No," the supervisor responded. "It is what it is. Do the actions that are required." Maybe it's an insanity test, Haggis thought. If you believe it, you're automatically kicked out. He considered that possibility. But when he read it again, he decided, this is madness. Chapter 2. Source. The many discrepancies between Hubbard's legend and his life have overshadowed the fact that he genuinely was a fascinating man, an explorer, a best-selling author, and the founder of a worldwide religious movement. The tug of war between Scientologists and anti-Scientologists over Hubbard's biography has created two swollen archetypes: the most important person who ever lived, and the world's greatest con man. Hubbard himself seemed to revolve on this same axis, constantly inflating his actual accomplishments in a manner that was rather easy for his critics to puncture. But to label him a pure fraud is to ignore the complex, charming, delusional, and visionary features of his character that made him so compelling to the many thousands who followed him and the millions who read his work. One would also have to ignore his life's labor in creating the intricately detailed epistemology that has pulled so many into its net, including, most prominently, Hubbard himself. Lafayette Ronald Hubbard was born in Tilden, Nebraska, in 1911, a striking, happy child with gray eyes and wispy, carrot-colored hair. His father, Harry Ross Hub Hubbard, was in the Navy when he met Ladora May Waterbury, who was studying to be a teacher in Omaha. They married in 1909. By the time their only child came along 2 years later, Hub was out of the service and working in the advertising department of the local Omaha newspaper. May returned to her hometown of Tilden for the birth. When Ron was two, the family moved to Helena, Montana, a gold town that was famous all over the West for its millionaires and its prostitutes. It was also the capital of the frontier state. Hub managed the family theater, which, despite its name, shared a building downtown with two bordellos. Even as a young child, Ron loved to watch the vaudeville acts that passed through, but the enterprise shut its doors when a larger theater opened nearby. Ron's maternal grandparents lived nearby. Lafayette Waterbury was a veterinarian and a well-regarded horseman who doted on his red-headed grandson. "I was riding Bronx at 3.5 years," Hubbard later boasted. He supposedly began reading at the same precocious age, and according to the church, he was soon devouring shelves of classics, including much of Western philosophy, the pillars of English literature, and, of note, the essays of Sigmund Freud. When the United States entered the First World War in 1917, Hubbard's father decided to re-enlist in the Navy. Ladora got a job with the state of Montana, and she and 6-year-old Ron moved in with her parents, who had relocated to Helena. When the war ended, Hub decided to make a career in the Navy, and the Hubbard family was launched into the itinerant military life. Hubbard's family was Methodist. He once remarked, "Many members of my family that I was raised with were devout Christians, and my grandfather was a devout atheist." Ron took his own eccentric path. Throughout his youth, he was fascinated by shamans and magicians. "As a boy in Montana," he says, "he was made a blood brother to the Blackfoot Indians by an elderly medicine man named Old Tom Madfeathers." Hubbard claims that Old Tom would put on displays of magic by leaping 15 feet high from a seated position and perching on the top of his teepee. Hubbard observes, "I learned long ago that man has his standards for credulity, and when reality clashes with these, he feels challenged." A signal moment in Hubbard's narrative is the 7,000-mile voyage he took in 1923 from Seattle through the Panama Canal to Washington, D.C., where his father was being posted. One of his fellow passengers was Commander Joseph C. "Snake" Thompson of the U.S. Navy Medical Corps. A neurosurgeon, a naturalist, and a former spy, Thompson made a vivid impression on the boy. "He was a very careless man," Hubbard later recalled. "He used to go to sleep reading a book, and when he woke up, why, he got up and never bothered to press and change his uniform, you know, and he was usually in very bad odor with the Navy Department." "But he was a personal friend of Sigmund Freud's. When he saw me, a defenseless character, and there was nothing to do on a big transport on a very long cruise, he started to work me over." No doubt Thompson entertained the young Hubbard with tales of his adventures as a spy in the Far East. Raised in Japan by his father, a missionary, Thompson spoke fluent Japanese. He had spent much of his early military career roaming through Asia, posing as a herpetologist looking for rare snakes while covertly gathering intelligence and charting possible routes of invasion. "What impressed me," Hubbard later remarked, "he had a cat by the name of Psycho. This cat had a crooked tail, which is enough to impress any young man, and the cat would do tricks. And the first thing he did was teach me how to train cats. But it takes so long, and it requires such tremendous patience, that to this day I have never trained a cat. You have to wait, evidently, for the cat to do something, then you applaud it. But waiting for a cat to do something whose name is Psycho." One of Thompson's maxims was, "If it's not true for you, it's not true." He told young Hubbard that the statement had come from Gautama Siddhartha, the Buddha. It made an impression on Hubbard. "If there's anybody in the world that's calculated to believe what he wants to believe and to reject what he doesn't want to believe, it is I." Thompson had just returned from Vienna, where he had been sent by the Navy to study under Freud. "I was just a kid, and Commander Thompson didn't have any boy of his own, and he and I just got along fine," Hubbard recalls in one of his lectures. Why he took it into his head to start beating Freud into my head, I don't know, but he did. And I wanted very much to follow out this work, wanted very much to. I didn't get a chance. My father said, "Son, you're going to be an engineer." Thompson was about to publish a review of psychoanalytic literature in the United States Naval Medical Bulletin. Indeed, he may have been working on it as he traveled to Washington, and no doubt he drew upon the thinking reflected in his article when he tutored Hubbard in the basics of Freudian theory. "Man has two fundamental instincts, one for self-preservation and the other for race propagation," Thompson writes in his review. "The most important emotion of the self-preservation urge is hunger. The sole emotion of the race propagation urge is libido." Psychoanalysis, Thompson explains, is the technic of discovering unconscious motivations that harm the health or happiness of the individual. Once the patient understands the motives behind his neurotic behavior, his symptoms automatically disappear. This uncovering of the hidden motive does not consist in the mere explaining to the patient the mechanism of his plight. The understanding alone comes from the analytic technic of free association and subsequent rational synthesis. Many of these thoughts are deeply embedded in the principles of Dianetics, the foundation of Hubbard's philosophy of human nature, which predated the establishment of Scientology. In 1927, Hubbard's father was posted to Guam, and Ladora went along, abandoning Ron to the care of her parents. For a man as garrulous as L. Ron Hubbard turned out to be, reflections on his parents are rare, almost to the point of writing them out of his biography. His story of himself reads like that of an orphan who has invented his own way in the world. One of his lovers later said that he told her that his mother was a whore and a lesbian, and that he had found her in bed with another woman. His mistress also admitted, "I never knew what to believe." Hubbard made two voyages to visit his parents in Guam. One trip included a detour to China, where he supposedly began his study of Eastern religions after encountering magicians and holy men. According to the church's narrative, he braved typhoons aboard a working schooner to finally land on the China coast. He then made his way inland to finally venture deep into forbidden Buddhist lamaseries. He watched monks meditating for weeks on end. Everywhere he went, the narrative goes, the teenage Hubbard was preoccupied with a central question: why? Why so much human suffering and misery? Why was man, with all his ancient wisdom and knowledge accumulated in learned texts and temples, unable to solve such basic problems as war, insanity, and unhappiness? In fact, Hubbard's contemporary journals don't really engage such philosophical points. His trip to China, which was organized by the YMCA, lasted only 10 days. His parents accompanied him, although they are not mentioned in his journals. He did encounter monks, whom he described as croaking like bullfrogs. The journals reflect the mind of a budding young imperialist who summons an unearned authority over an exotic and unfamiliar culture. The very nature of the Chinaman holds him back, Hubbard observes on the ship back to Guam. The trouble with China is there are too many chinks here. The journals provide a portrait of an adolescent writer trying on his future craft by cataloging plot ideas such as a young American in India with an organized army for rent to the various rajas, usual plot complications. Another idea, love story, goes to France, meets swell broad in Marseille. He is trying, uncertainly, to find his voice. Rex Fraser mounted the knoll and, setting his hat more securely against the wind, squinted at the huddle of unpainted shacks below him. "So this," he said to his horse, "is Montana City." Hubbard entered the School of Engineering at George Washington University in the fall of 1930. He was a poor student, failing German and calculus, but he excelled in extracurricular activities. He began writing for the school newspaper. A new literary magazine at GWU provided a venue for his first published works of fiction. He became director of the Gliding Club, a thrilling new pastime that was just catching on. Hubbard's gliding license was number 385. The actual study of engineering was a secondary pursuit, as his failing grades reflected. In September 1931, Hubbard and his friend Philip Flip Browning took a few weeks off to barnstorm through the Midwest in an Aero Sport biplane. "We carefully wrapped our baggage, threw the fire extinguisher out to save half a horsepower, patched a hole in the upper wing, and started off to skim over 4 or 5 states with the wind as our only compass," Hubbard writes. By now he had taken to calling himself Flash. Hubbard's account of this adventure, Tailwind Willies, was his first commercially published story, appearing in The Sportsman Pilot in January 1932. It was the launch of an unprecedented career. He would go on to publish more books than any other author, according to the 2006 Guinness World Records, with 1,084 titles. In the spring of 1932, at the height of the Great Depression, Hubbard undertook a venture that displayed many of the hallmarks of his future exploits. He posted a notice on several university campuses. "Restless young men with wanderlust wanted for the Caribbean Motion Picture Expedition. Cost to applicant $250 payable at the dock in Baltimore before sailing. Must be healthy, dependable, resourceful, imaginative, and adventurous. No tea hounds or tourist material need apply." The goals of the expedition were grand and various, primarily to make newsreels for Fox Movietone and Pathé News while exploring the pirate haunts of the Caribbean and voodoo rites in Haiti. There were also vague plans to collect whatever one collects for exhibits in museums. "It's difficult at any age to recognize a messiah in the making," wrote one of the young men, James S. Free, a journalist who signed on to the expedition. He was 23 years old, 2 years older than Hubbard. They were going to be partners in the adventure, along with Hubbard's old flying buddy, Phil Browning. "I cannot claim prescient awareness that my soon-to-be business partner possessed the ego and talents that would later develop his own private religion," Free wrote in a notebook he titled Preview of a Messiah. Hubbard was living with his parents in Washington, D.C. when Free arrived. "Ron introduced me to his mother,
whose long, light brown hair seemed dark beside the reddish glow of her son's hair and face, Free wrote, in one of the few records of the actual relationship between Hubbard and his mother. I recall little else about her except that, like her husband, Navy Lieutenant Henry Ross Hubbard, she plainly adored young Ron and considered him a budding genius. Hubbard filled Free in on new developments. Phil Browning, the other partner, had dropped out at the last minute, but he had managed to get the loan of some laboratory equipment from the University of Michigan. Meantime, Hubbard was negotiating with a professional cameraman for the anticipated films of the voodoo rites and that sort of saleable material. Thanks to Free's efforts to sign up more than 20 new members of the expedition, Hubbard said, "We have enough cash to go ahead."